Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And tonight we're going to look at one of the final parts of Everyday Stalinism, the epic work by Sheila Fitzpatrick that we've been working through together for such a long time. We're going to look at the year of the Great Terror, or the kind of the key year of the Great Terror, shall we say, of 1937. Of course, there are different historiographies of the Terror. Some, Robert Service, for example, have argued that there was kind of no distinguishing between 1937 and any other year from 1917 onwards in terms of terror, and the Stalinist system, the Bolshevik and then the Stalinist system, was one long period of terror. I'm not sure that I necessarily agree that there are no distinguishing features, and that there was no distinction between the Bolshevik and the Stalinist periods. Much of the debate, of course, comes down to how one positions Lenin and Stalin's relationship. The sympathetic biographers of Lenin, who see him as the revolutionary figure whose vision was somehow fatally compromised by Stalin, I think it's utterly naive to take that view, that the Leninist period had to be for Lenin's visions of Russia to come true, and for his ideological take on what individuals were, for that to be realised, terror was at the heart of it. The view, the Marxist-Leninist view, that Lenin had of individuals was that they were kind of rather, you know, the individual is rather like clay and can be reshaped based on the social forces around them. You know, you reshape the society, you reshape the man. And of course, the tools to do that are violence and coercion. Anyway, tonight we're going to look at 1937. Before we do, firstly, a quick apology. I've been away for a couple of weeks, so this podcast has been kind of gathering dust for a week or two. So for everyone who regularly listens, an apology there. Also, a really great announcement. We'll be I'll be speaking with Otto English from Byline Times, who is a great investigative and critical journalist with Byline Times, whose new book, A Fake History, the kind of the great historical myths that seem to pervade our society, we'll be examining that next week, and giving special attention to Boris Johnson's biography of Winston Churchill, which I of course have always argued can't be thought of as being a biography at all, we will be casting a critical eye over that, so stay tuned. So let's talk about the year 1937. So, the year 1937 is obviously the height of the Stalinist terror. And Sheila Fitzpatrick talks here a little bit about the kind of premonitions, the warning signs. She writes, "There had been rumblings ever since Kirov's death in 1934, and the localized waves of terror that followed it. The first of the three great Moscow show trials of the former oppositionists, the trial of Zinoviev and Kamenev in August 1936, initiated a round of arrests of former oppositionists, but this was still on a relatively small scale. Mass arrests in the communist elite and the episode of hysterical witch hunting, we now know as the Great Purges, began in the first months of 1937 with the January show trial of Yuri Pyatakov and the other former communist leaders for counter-revolutionary wrecking and sabotage and the bloodthirsty plenary meeting of the Central Communist Committee that followed. Although it was almost 2 years before the terror started to wind down and Nikolai Yezhov was removed as the head of the NKVD, the whole episode was long remembered by Soviet citizens as the year 1937. The three trials had a strong structural resemblance to the show trials of the Cultural Revolution, the Shakti trial of 1928, and the Industrial Party trial of 1930. The difference was that the defendants had been bourgeois specialists, charged with as representatives of their class as part of the campaign against the old intelligentsia. This time, the defendants were the high communist officials very recently removed from top positions. The inference that they, too, were on trial as representatives of a class was there to be drawn. But the question was, what class? One possible reading was that the class of former opposition was it was the class of former oppositionists. The other, considerably more disturbing in its implications, was that the whole communist managerial class was now on trial. So the reason, one of the many reasons for the trials of the bourgeois specialists prior to the trials of the Great Terror was that the shortcomings of the revolution, the failings of the revolution, the fact that the five-year plans were difficult to implement, that there were industrial accidents and failings and disasters, that targets and norms weren't met. Somebody had to be blamed. The idea that the party was ill-equipped to manage such a radical transformation of Russia, and that Stalin himself had failed in many ways and made huge mistakes, or that the regime itself was at fault in some way, couldn't be entertained. There had to be external enemies. And so when we get to 1937, we've already been through a famine, And the various other kind of social shockwaves, you know, poverty, hunger, shortages that shake Soviet society during the 1930s. And when you get to that point, sure, there are grievances, there are resentments, there are criticisms. And the whilst the likes of Kamenev, Zinoviev, Pyatikov, and the rest, and Bukharin, are put on trial for treason, for sabotage, for conspiring against the Soviet state, they're a great way of explaining why things still don't work out. And this attack on the infrastructure of the party itself was a way of sweeping away a tier of society, a social tier that existed between Stalin and the population at large. And of course, the dream of any dictator is the unfettered support of the populace. The theme of the Pyatikov trial was wrecking, writes Julia Fitzpatrick, meaning intentional sabotage of the Soviet economy by highly placed officials who were secret enemies of Soviet power. Yuri Pyatikov, one of the chief defendants, was a former supporter of Trotsky, who had recanted in the early 1930s, had been readmitted to the party, and become the right-hand man of Sergei Orjonikidze at the Ministry of Heavy Industry. He was accused of treason against the country, espionage, committing acts of diversion, wrecking activities, and the preparation of terrorist acts. Prosecutor Vashinsky put on a dramatic performance, describing in astonishing detail the awful outlines of the conspiracy of former oppositionists, their master, Judas Trotsky, the German and Japanese intelligence agencies against Soviet power. They were a brigand gang, murderers, toadies, and cads of capitalism, Vashinsky claimed. This is not a political party, it is merely a gang of criminals, hardly to be distinguished from the gangsters who use blackjacks and daggers on the high road on a dark night. Fearful of the masses, from which it runs like the devil from the holy water, the gang conceals its brutal claws and ferocious fangs. The roots of this gang must be sought in the secret recesses of the foreign espionage agencies, which brought these people, which kept them, paid them for their loyal flunky service. The trial was reported almost verbatim in all national newspapers, with banner headlines, photographs of the cowed defendants, and box statements by indignant Soviet citizens calling for the death penalty. So all of this sounds to our ears fanciful stuff. But it wasn't meant to sound fanciful. It was meant to sound plausible. The trial, the managers of the show trials, the prosecutors, were trying to do the do their judicial work in public. They were trying to build a relationship, a rapport, and an agreement with the population at large by portraying the likes of Pyatikov as traitors, and by presenting that treachery as being wildly, wildly damaging and destructive and malevolent, and the more lurid the tale, quite frankly, the better. Stalin, Molotov, and Yezhov spelled out the message to a terrified Central Committee at the plenary meeting that began in February. Their speeches lent considerable weight to the reading that the class on trial in the Pyatikov trial was the communist managerial elite. It turned out, they said, that Pyatikov and co. were not only the only wreckers in industry. In fact, wreckers were flourishing everywhere, and the industrial and transport apparatus, overlooked by complacent communists who had forgotten about vigilance, and not all the wreckers were former oppositionists. They were enemies of the people in other branches of the Soviet government too. In addition, wreckers and traitors had wormed their way into top positions in the regional party administrations. This was particularly distressing news to the Central Committee, many of whose members were themselves regional secretaries. Of course, a lot of these people were Stalin appointees from about 1921 onwards. 1922, I beg your pardon. And so Stalin presents a kind of an alarming and distressing world view to the party at the Central Committee, and basically informs them in a manner of speaking that not everybody will be surviving.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
And that those who do should be constantly vigilant and fearful and worried and paranoiac about the possibility of wreckers and saboteurs around them, even if they themselves were given initially to believing that there were no such wreckers and saboteurs. Over the next few months, newspapers carried a wealth of startling information about the sins of leading communists in the centre and the regions. These news items usually refrained from stating outright that the subject, unmasked as an enemy of the people, had been or would shortly be arrested. But this was obvious to any experienced reader of the Soviet press. A lot of what you see in the Soviet press of the 1930s is done by implication, by innuendo, by hint, by suggestion. And Soviet citizens became, as it suggests here, master kind of readers of which way the wind was blowing as a result of what they read about in the press, master kind of interpreters of these sorts of things. The stories were written in such a way as to arouse all the latent hostility of Soviet citizens to elite privileges and the arbitrary exercise of power. Enemies of the people have practiced patronage and favouritism, bullied subordinates, and been rude to ordinary citizens, developed their own local cults of personality, used state funds to support a luxurious lifestyle of banquets, dashes, cars, foreign and consumer goods, and expensive clothes. Now, that was a very interesting feature of the kind of like the slander of these party members, many of whom had legitimately, if they were put on trial in a democratic society, would have been put on trial for all sorts of different things, bear in mind. But the way in which they are portrayed in a country that is constantly beset by shortages, by housing shortages, food shortages, by ongoing hunger, and the inability to buy basic goods in shops, even when there are party stores that are quite well stocked, was to present them as hypocrites, as frauds, as liars, as people who were not the idealists looking to build a new world, but kind of grifters on the make. The atmosphere of the time strongly anti-elitist, anti-bossist, was encapsulated in Stalin's toast in October to the little people, in which he remarked that leaders come and go, but the people remain. Only the people are eternal. In this highly charged atmosphere, standard practices suddenly became fraught with sinister meaning. Take the families of clients and connections that every central and regional political figure gathered around himself. It was natural, most people in normal times would have agreed, to want to be surrounded by your own people, to bring trusted lieutenants with you when you change jobs, to protect your people if some Moscow busybody started to make trouble for them, to cooperate with others in your ministry or regional party organisation, to show the achievements of the institutional region in the best possible light. But now, all such efforts seem suspect, smacking of conspiracy. So, what can we make of that? Well, you may have remembered a long time ago when we talked about the nature of Soviet society in the 1920s and 30s, that influence favours, what was referred to as blat, which is this Russian term for who you know, became much, much more important than really what you know, or how hard you work, or how talented you are. This was a society which had definite, you know, meritocratic pretensions and designs, and egalitarian pretensions and designs. However, it was an enormously corrupt society. It was a society of poverty and hunger and shortages, where party bosses could influence things in such a way to make sure that if you were friends with them or related to them or had connections to them, that life could be good. But what happens when the people who have been your benefactors, friends, saviours, who have looked out for you, who you have used your blat, your influence, to secure an apartment or a place at a school for your child, what happens if those people are denounced? Or what happens if you are denounced and they have vouched for you? All of a sudden, these social networks, these informal networks, these networks of blat started to be a lot more danger than they were an asset, and subsequently a great many of them are kind of very, very quickly broken up. In one instance, Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, a provincial newspaper had a field day with the clientist tendencies of G.P. Savenko, director of the local coke chemical plant, when he was exposed as an enemy of the people. Savenko, the paper reported, had brought his own people with him, including class enemies and former Trotskyites, when he moved from Dnipropetrovsk to the Donbass and gave them all sorts of perks, cosseting these confidence men and rascals in every way. Over 2 years, 1935-1936, he spent 114,000 rubles from discretionary funds for bonuses, whose recipients included an unmasked wrecker, the son of a White Cossack officer, a former Trotskyite, the son of a big pre-revolutionary manufacturer who'd been expelled from the party for speculating in gold and other undesirables. Savenko also spent money from the director's fund for lavish banquets. This, the newspaper pointed out, was in sharp contrast to the miserly amount available for cultural purposes, workers' housings, and other worthy causes. So, there is a at the initial stages of the terror in 1937, a kind of almost populist aspect to it of harnessing public anger, public rage, public indignation, public loathing for those who were going to be victimised. How true any of the accusations are is perhaps almost impossible for us to tell. Certainly, almost certainly, they are embellished if there's a grain of truth to them. It was probably to have that assortment of class enemies together in one place is either enormously bad luck or or untrue. The need for to present the enemies of the people, those who are going to be put on trial, who are going to be purged, as kind of the almost the NEP men of the 1920s, of these kind of, they use terms like gangster, crook, spiv, confidence men and rascals quite regularly as an interesting kind of linguistic kind of discourse happening here. The idea that essentially somehow the revolution had become corrupted and needed in a way to be purified, to be purged, and that Stalin was able to do that. This is the kind of the language that actually makes mass terror more likely. I don't think that there was anything that would have ever stopped the terror itself, but here you a kind of a workable explanation as to why these arrests are happening is presented to the Soviet people. So what we're going to do when we continue with this, and I'll do some more on this later this week, because working through the terror I think is really important, is focus on the final stages of the terror, how it spreads and radicalizes and sort of grows exponentially, and it does it through denunciations, through these social networks that we see, and it spreads almost out of the party and into all aspects of Soviet life, particularly with a focus on nationalities. The Poles who are in the Soviet Union are those who are disproportionately persecuted by the regime. Okay, let's finish there. So I'll be hopefully getting out a lot more content to you in the next few days and weeks. My former laptop, the laptop that has produced well over 1,000 of these podcasts and has been with me for 10 years, finally has given up the ghost and died today. So I'm using an entirely different system, and one which will be a lot quicker and more efficient. But spare a thought for the old MacBook Pro as it goes to the great microprocessor in the sky or whatever. Anyway, catch us next time when I'll be chatting with Otto English. It's going to be really, really interesting to have him on the show. And do remember to check us out at www.explaininghistory.org. I'll be putting some new content on there pretty soon. And also, if you're able to sponsor the podcast, do come to again check out our Patreon page through the website and donate what you can. It's small donations that keep us going here, and the tiny little insignificant trickle of ad revenue. Thanks very much, everybody. Take good care. All the best. Bye bye. Thank you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.